ஓம் நமோ பகவதே வாசுதேவாய. So today we are going to read from 7th canto, 9th chapter. Prahlad pacifies the Lord with prayers, text 25. The speaker, the thing is all right then? Yeah. Oh. How is the sound today? So I decided to discuss the verse 25 today. We skipped a few verses. Maybe I can just read the translation of previous two verses. That will give us. My dear Lord, this is text 23. My dear Lord, people in general want to be elevated to the higher planetary systems for a long duration of life, opulence and enjoyment. But I have seen all of these through the activities of my father. When my father was angry and he laughed sarcastically at the demigods, they're immediately vanquished simply by seeing the movements of his eyebrows. Yet my father, who was so powerful, has now been vanquished by you within a moment. My dear Lord, now I have complete experience concerning the worldly opulence, mystic power, longevity and other material pleasures enjoyed by all living entities from Lord Brahma down to an ant. As powerful time, you destroy them all. Therefore, because of my experience, I do not wish to possess them. My dear Lord, I request you to place me in touch with your pure devotee and let me serve him as a sincere servant. This verse also was very nice, but I decided to go on to text 25. Kutra shisha shruti sukha mriga trishni rupa Kvedaṁ kalevaraṁ aśeṣa rujaṁ viroha Nirviddhate natu jano jadapīti vidvān Kāma nalaṁ madhulavai shamayan durāpai. In this material world, every living entity desires some fruitive happiness, which is exactly like a mirage in the desert. Where is water in the desert? Or in other words, where is happiness in this material world? As for this body, what's its value? It is merely a source of various diseases. The so-called philosophers, scientists and politicians know this very well. But nonetheless, they aspire for temporary happiness. Happiness is very difficult to obtain. But because they are unable to control their senses, they run after the so-called happiness of the material world and never come to the right conclusion. So please repeat after me. In this material world, every living entity desires some future happiness. In this material world, every living entity desires some future happiness, which is exactly like a mirage in the desert. Where is water in the desert? Or in other words, where is happiness in this material world? As for this body, what is its value? It is merely a source of various diseases. The so-called philosophers, scientists and politicians know this very well, but nonetheless, they aspire for temporary happiness. Happiness is very difficult to obtain. But because they are unable to control their senses, they run after the so-called happiness of the material world and never come to the right conclusion. There is a song in the Bengali language which states, I constructed this home for happiness, but unfortunately there was a fire and everything has now been burnt to ashes. This illustrates the nature of material happiness. Everyone knows it, but nonetheless one plans to hear or think something very pleasing. Unfortunately, all of one's plans are annihilated in due course of time. There are many politicians who planned empires, supremacy and control of the world. But in due time, all their plans and empires and even the politicians themselves were vanquished. Everyone should take lesson from Prahlad Maharaj about how we are engaged in so-called temporary happiness through bodily exercises of sense enjoyment. All of us repeatedly make plans which are all repeatedly frustrated. Therefore, one should stop such plan making. As one cannot stop a blazing fire by constantly pouring ghee upon it, one cannot satisfy oneself by increasing plans for sense enjoyment. The blazing fire is Bhava Maha Dabagni, the forest fire of material existence. This forest fire occurs automatically without endeavor. We want to be happy in the material world, but this will never be possible. We shall simply increase the blazing fire of desires. Our desires cannot be satisfied by illusory thoughts and plans. Rather, we have to follow the instructions of Lord Krishna. Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam braja. Then we shall be happy. Otherwise, in the name of happiness, we shall continue to suffer miserable conditions. Kutra shishasruti sukha mrigatrishni rupa kvedang kalevaram ashesha rujang viroha nirviddate natu jano jadopiti vidvan kamanalang madhulabai Shamayan Durapai. In this material world, every living entity desires some future happiness, which is exactly like a mirage in the desert. Where is water in the desert, or in other words, where is happiness in this material world? As for this body, what's its value? It is merely a source of various diseases. The so-called philosophers, scientists and politicians know this very well. But nonetheless, they aspire for temporary happiness. Happiness is very difficult to obtain. But because they are unable to control their senses, they run after the so-called happiness of the material world and never come to the right conclusion. So, Prahlad Maharaj is praying to Nrisimhadev. Actually, these prayers are manifestation of his, or expression of his transcendental wisdom. When one becomes situated in proper Krishna consciousness, then only he becomes truly wise, because then only he sees things in a from a right point of view, right perspective. Generally, in the material nature, people are running after sense gratification. They call their sense gratification as happiness. Sense gratification means desiring something for the pleasure of our senses, and when we get that, we feel happy. But then we indulge in that sense gratification. And what is the result of that indulgence? The result of that indulgence is unhappiness. We desire something for happiness, but when you fulfill that, when you have that, when you look at its outcome, then we find it is a source of suffering. We wanted happiness, but what we got is suffering. We wanted joy, but what we got is punishment. And Prabhupada cited a few lines from Vidyapati, a great Vaishnava poet. He wrote there's a Bengali song by him. It says, Shukhero lagiya eghoro badhino anale puriya gelo. In order to get happiness, I created my home. I built a house. I constructed this home for happiness. I created this family life. I created this home for the sake of happiness. A young man falls in love with a young girl. And he thinks that if he could marry this girl, then he'll become happy. So he gets married, he builds a home. But eventually what happens? Anale puriya gelo. Anal means fire. And puriya gelo, burnt. I built a house, very nicely I constructed the house, I used a lot of money, lot of energy, but all of a sudden there was a fire, and the house got burnt out. So that is our situation in the material nature. And Prahlad Maharaj had described that as Mrigatrishni Rupa. Mrigatrisha means, or Mrigatrishna means a mirage. And Rupa means like. Our endeavor for material enjoyment is like a mirage, running after a mirage. We are mriga. Mriga means deer, losing its way in the desert. It runs. What does he see? The deer becomes thirsty, and it sees a mirage, and he thinks that there is water, and it runs after that. But the more he runs after that, what happens? The more he is running deeper into the desert, which will cause him to die. And not only a deer, although a deer is an innocent, unintelligent animal, but even human beings, those who are very intelligent, they see, they're losing their way in the desert. When they see a mirage, which is actually an illusory impression of water, runs after that. But the more he runs after that, the more the mirage runs away from him. So, material happiness is something like that. We are running after something which is not real. We never get it. The more we run after it, the more it runs away from us. And the more we run after it, the more dangerous our situation becomes. Never ever will we be able to quench our thirst running after a mirage. Similarly, never ever will we be able to quench the thirst of our hearts by running after sense gratification, material enjoyment. So that's why it has been compared to building a house with so much expectations and aspiration. One builds the house. He thinks that I will live happily ever after in this house. Whatever his highest expectations, highest desires, he just puts it in there. And then one day it gets burnt out. It may not literally get burnt out, but it gets burnt out in various other ways. The person himself dies. There are so many instances where people are building houses, but before the house was complete even, they died. They put all their energy, all their wealth, beautiful palace, died before, he couldn't even enter into that house. What to speak of living there? That also reminds me, like, in Italy, near Milan, we bought a beautiful property, and we got it at a very, very good rate, good price. Huge, which was actually a village. Huge piece of land, beautiful house. And why, when I was told, Madhusavita Prabhu, who bought the house, he told me, what actually happened, the person who built the house got divorced. Now his wife is claiming a part of the house, share of the house. They can't live in the same house together now. So they have to sell the house. That's where the house has gone into the market. The amount of money they spent, they couldn't even get a fraction. I mean, they just got a fraction of it. So, onole puliyagalu, got burnt in fire. So, this is the material nature. We expect our happiness to derive happiness from all kinds of material arrangements, but those arrangements ultimately do not become successful. There are so many such wonderful examples. I was told that once, in America actually, somebody was telling me that a couple just got married. They were deeply in love with each other. They had to overcome many, many obstacles to get married. The family was not favorable and so forth. But then eventually they got married. Such a wonderful happening. Ultimately their dream came true. They got married. And after the marriage, as they were going to their honeymoon, they ran into a railway track. And right at that time the train came. Something happened, most probably the level crossing didn't go down or something. They just drove in and the train just came. And their bodies were found 3 or 4 miles away from that place. Like they were, so can you imagine what a culmination of their, what an ending. And that also, I mean this is what fate is. Like at the time when they are just going to their honeymoon, expecting the culmination of their fruition of their marriage, just ended up in such an accident. And it's understandable, the car came there and the car probably was, you know, just dragged on by the train, like it was not just thrown out, like just dragged on. So, this is how people become victims of the laws of material nature. And an intelligent person will learn from that. And Prabhupada is pointing out that the philosophers, the politicians, the scientists, they know that. They know that. After all, they have some intelligence. They can see. All the people in the past, they made so many different endeavors, but all their endeavors were unsuccessful. Like when Ambarish Prabhu often remembers that Henry Ford's great-grandson, Alfred Ford, who is our godbrother, Ambarish Prabhu. Amrish Prabhu was telling me that when he went to first meet Srila Prabhupada, so he was in a very, with lot of excitement, he was introduced to Srila Prabhupada, that he is Henry Ford's great-grandson. But Prabhupada's response to that was, where is Henry Ford today? Where is Henry Ford today? Or, where is Henry Ford now? And it occurred to Ambarish Prabhu, it's true. Henry Ford, such a great person, did so much, and now he is famous because he happens to be his great-grandson. But where is Henry Ford now? Where is he? And it occurred to him that yes, this is how temporary our existence in this material nature is, and this is how futile all our endeavors in this material nature is. Our existence is so temporary, and we do not know where we will go. Henry Ford may have been a great man in this during his lifetime, but who knows what may have happened to him. Once Prabhupada mentioned that Nehru was a great first president of India, a first prime minister of India, a very well known person, reputed all over the world for his political achievements and political strife. And Prabhupada said that he was born as a dog in Sweden. Today he is the Prime Minister of India, and tomorrow he is a dog in Sweden. So this is, and obviously Prabhupada was not joking when he said that, he was serious. So he is born, Prabhupada told, he is born as a dog in Sweden. At least he has been born as a dog. So many people are born as a cockroach. They build a big house, and because they are attached to that house, because of their attachment to the house, they are born again to build, to live in that house. But as what? As a tiny little cockroach. And maybe his son and grandson are chasing and trying to kill it. Oh, cockroach, what a disgusting creature, get rid of it. So the real understanding, real wisdom is to see things from a greater perspective. That's why it's important to read the Vedic scriptures. The scriptures that are not that philosophical, rather a narration of the activities of the personalities in the past, like Ramayana and Mahabharata. Ramayana and Mahabharata are simple reading. Srimad Bhagavatam is heavy reading. It's saturated with philosophy. Now what to speak of Vedanta Sutra and all that. Vedanta Sutra is very dry. It's just pure philosophy. Not only philosophy, it's philosophical aphorisms, like formulas. And those formulas have been explained and simplified in Srimad Bhagavatam. Therefore, Bhagavatam is relatively easier reading. But much easier reading is Mahabharata and Ramayana. It's very exciting. But when you read Mahabharata and Ramayana, what do we find? Few things become so clear. One thing becomes clear is about reincarnation. This life is not everything. There are lives before. Behind so many characters there are descriptions, who they were in the previous life, why they took a birth like this. There is such systematic analysis. For example, Putana. Why did she come as a witch, as a demoness? And why did she get the position of a mother? A mother-like personality in the spiritual sky. It has been described that Putana in the Puranas, actually, this is not from Mahabharata, it's from Puran. Putana, in her previous life, was Vrindavali, the wife of Bali Maharaj. And she, when she saw Bamandev, her heart was filled with parental affection, motherly affection. She saw this child and she wished, "I wish he was my son." He saw Bamandev and he wished he was my son. But then when he recognized Bamandev's actual identity and she saw how Bamandev deceived Bali Maharaj and took away everything from him in order to give it to the demigods, she became very, very upset. And she reflected that, yes, I wanted him as a child, as my son, but I would have killed him by giving him poison. So she desired that in her previous life, and that desire became fulfilled in her next life. She came to Krishna. She came to kill Krishna. And she came dressed as a mother. She was showing motherly affection towards Krishna. Picked up Krishna, the baby Krishna, 7 days old, and started to play with him. And she offered her breast to him. But that breast was smeared with poison in order to kill Krishna. But when Krishna sucked her breast, he also sucked the life air from her body. And because she treated Krishna as a mother, Krishna is so grateful. This also confirms this point, as Ramchandra was telling Bali Maharaj. Ramchandra was telling about Vibhishan that if one comes even to pretend to surrender with an ulterior motive, even to kill him, still he gives him liberation. I mean, still he protects him. And one example is this. She came to kill Krishna, but Krishna gave her Krishna not only liberated her, but gave her the position of a mother in the spiritual sky. That is how grateful Krishna is. Okay, since you came pretending to be my mother, I'll give you the position of my mother. At least you came to surrender to me. Pretentiously, still I will give you. So this is how grateful Krishna is. So the point is, like this, scriptures actually give us a very clear understanding of surrendering to the Lord and the broader perception of reality. This life is not the only life. We were here before, and whatever is happening to us in this life is a result of our previous actions. We must have acted in the past in a certain way, therefore I am getting the result in this way. Sometimes I recall there, when I was young, I used to listen to some English songs that I remember, and I can see that there also they have this concept, like somewhere in my youth I must have done something good, therefore I got you today. So like so karmic reaction is being, I must have done something good, that's why I'm getting the result in this way, in a favorable way like this. And And it is a total misconception in Christianity that Christianity doesn't believe in reincarnation, rebirth. Like, if we go deeper into it, actually, unfortunate thing about Christianity is that it has been presented by people, those who are not spiritual personalities. Christianity was not established by Jesus Christ. Christianity was established by Constantine, who was a king. He was not a spiritual personality. He was a politician. He was a king. And therefore, he presented it in a certain way according to his understanding. Therefore, we see that Roman Catholicism, more of a spiritual thing, it's more of a regal thing. The Pope and all these guys dress up like, in such a gorgeous way. And I remember that long back I saw a movie about St. Francis of Assisi. And St. Francis of Assisi was standing in front of the Pope. The Pope was going to judge him. And he was actually, St. Francis was preaching to him that you are a man of God. Why did you degrade yourself into this condition? Look at yourself. Let your soul leap out of your body and your designations and soar high in the sky. And I mean, he was preaching to, and you could see who was closer to Jesus, the Pope or St. Francis, although St. Francis was taken to Pope as a convict, as a blasphemer. They accused him of blasphemy. And he was, so this is how sometimes religion loses its actual purpose. And that's what happened to practically all the religions of this world today. Therefore, Bhagavatam is saying that whatever goes on in the name of religion in this world is nothing but cheating. Dharma prajita koitavat. Dharma means religion, koitava means cheating. Whatever is going on in the name of religion in this world is nothing but cheating. So give up those cheating religions. Then only you'll be able to understand real religion. Vedang vastavam astatra vastu shivanam tapasthanam. That is a real religion. Developing, first of all, understanding the Supreme Personality of God and developing our loving relationship. So that is the goal of life. So that goal must be pursued. So and when you come to Srimad Bhagavatam, then you get understanding, the real understanding. And that's why it has been said, prithivite jato kichu dharma name chale bhagavat kahe taha paripurna chale. Whatever goes on in the name of religion in this world, Bhagavat says that they are all filled with deception and cheating. And what is the real religion? Mam ekam sharanam braja. Surrender unto Krishna. That is where real religion begins. Real religion begins when one gives up all religion and surrenders unto Krishna. And it's happening all over the world. I mean, if I look around, I'll see most of you practically gave up your so-called religion that you are practicing. And you have come to the platform of pure devotional service, surrendering to Krishna. And the surrendering to Krishna is not the ultimate. Surrendering to Krishna is the beginning. That's why we see the last word of Bhagavad Gita is the first instruction of Srimad Bhagavatam. Where Bhagavad Gita ended, Srimad Bhagavatam began. So our dharma is Bhagavad Dharma. What has been presented in Srimad Bhagavatam, which means actually the relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the ultimate dharma. Dharman bhagavatan iha. That is the Bhagavad Dharma. Dharman bhagavatan iha. Surrendering to the Supreme Personality is the beginning of developing a relationship with Him. And then we develop the relationship. Then we cultivate the relationship. Then the relationship becomes enhanced, deeper and deeper. And that relationship then culminates into love. Then love also has different phases, different levels. And it takes us higher and higher in this path of dharma or religion. So that is what Prahlad Maharaj is saying. Don't run after these mundane pursuits. Don't run after illusory sense gratification. You're not going to get any happiness out of it. Rather develop your relationship with Krishna and you'll see what happens. Surrender unto Krishna. Now that I have found you, all this while I have seen, my father was such a powerful person. He was so powerful that even the demigods used to tremble just by hearing his name. So powerful. Powerful means he was such a tyrant. And he was such an enjoyer. In order to enjoy, he underwent such austerity. Such austerity, simply in order to enjoy in this material nature. But what did they get? In a moment he was finished by you. That's what Prahlad Maharaj said in the previous verse. And now I learned, I understood how futile all these endeavors are. My father underwent so much difficulties, so much, such severe austerities in order to enjoy. But what happened to him? His body is just lying there. Dead. So let us learn something from that. And let us learn that surrendering to your lotus feet is the ultimate goal of our existence. So let me just surrender unto you, my Lord. That's Prahlad Maharaj's prayer. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Gaur Premanande Hari Hari. Does anybody have any question? Yes, sure.
One comment. You mentioned the scenario of the person becoming a cockroach. To a non-devotee, and even I'll admit, even to me, although I have faith in that, in such a scenario, it seems so almost like a caricature. It seems almost surreal, and so simplistic, and like a children's storybook, so caricature-like. So is it really like that? One question would occur, like, is that reality? Is it really
A group of scientists are sitting together and discussing about theory of relativity, and a bunch of children they come across and they wonder, what are they talking about?
But in that case it seems too complicated to them.
This is also too complicated. It's too complicated for them to understand the law of nature. That is why they think it's caricature. It's too complicated for them. That's why they can't understand it. It is not that everybody is becoming a cockroach or a dog in Sweden, right? There are some people there being elevated as a demigod. There are some people, those who are finishing their business in this material nature and going back to Godhead. So it's not just one case scenario. You have to see the thing in totality. Why should we take just one part? We have to see things in a total perspective. Not that everybody is becoming cockroach in the next life. You act properly, you'll get the result accordingly. What's the next question?
Regarding the comment that most of us came to Krishna consciousness having given up our previous religious affiliation, it occurred to me that so many children in ISKCON today, especially in the Western world, although being born in the Vaishnava tradition, unfortunately don't take it up seriously. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Yeah, as you use the expression, unfortunately, it's unfortunately they were not trained properly, guided properly, taken care of properly. Right? Like it's, you know, we have to take the responsibility for that. Like, I mean, if we, of course, hindsight is always 20/20. So. But you know, if you look at it, in most cases our Gurukul teachers were not the best of the devotees. Oftentimes they were the worst of the devotees. There was no good for anything, they were just put into the Gurukul to become teachers. We treated our children as if they are all pure devotees from their birth, and we thought that they will grow up to become the four Kumaras. Like we brought them up in that way, very strict, very rigid, and we fed them with the ideas that the devotees are the only worthwhile living entities, and all those who are living outside, they are a bunch of demons. And so we kind of fed them with all kinds of ideas which were not real, or which were not really favorable for their growing up and maturity. I'm not talking about all, I'm just also painting the worst case scenario of our Gurukul situation. And then we when they graduated, when they finished their schools, or rather, when you are training them, we just took it for granted that they will become devotees. We never considered that they have to go out, they may go out and have to fend for themselves. We didn't consider that they may go into the higher education in the colleges and universities. We just took it for granted that they will just grow up and they'll become our preachers and so forth. Preachers and pujaris. But then when they grew up, we didn't give them any engagement. They finished their schools and now you fend for yourself. You decide for, figure out what you're going to do. We are not. And of course, unfortunately, ISKCON also went through a major crisis around that time. So many of our leaders left the movement and so many devotees were driven out of the movement. So many, when the leaders fell down, so many of the followers also left with them. And our movement was faced with a terrible crisis. And there was no, I mean, everybody was so absorbed in just putting the broken pieces together, there was no time to take care of our children who just came out of their schools. And there was no engagement in ISKCON. They were brought up with an idea that they will become absorbed in ISKCON. But when they actually came out, finished their studies, there was no service for them. And actually at that time there was no service for anyone. The only service available was you either become a pujari or a cook or a pot washer. Only few temples were distributing Prabhupada's books. Book distribution also practically came to a halt. And then they had to go out and face the world. They didn't know how to deal with that. and then they got absorbed in that world, and as a result of that, like while we were teaching them that outside there they all are demons, now they are thinking in ISKCON we all are demons. Because we messed up their lives. And you know, it's a very, very unfortunate state of affairs, and we have to take take the blame for that. Anyway, so there has been a loss, and let's learn. There had been a mistake, so let's learn from our mistakes and make it a point not to make the same mistake. Anybody, any comment? I would like to hear what's your perception.
I have observed that young parents were very good parents, very good family. Their daughters, they trained them very nicely, you know, and in a very conservative way, you know, and dress them in a way that they hear the Krishna conscious way. After some time, you know, a few years, you know, they started doing the opposite thing.
They're revolting against that, right?
They want to expose what the material world is. They want to find out what it is. Even their good parents, good family.
Yeah, right.
To train the children right, you know,
in a conscious way. And to look at it in a positive way or in a favorable way, I'll have to say that, you see, this movement is very young. And, you know, the pioneering stage is always a difficult stage. Like today we all are enjoying in America, but can you imagine the amount of difficulties and hardships the pioneers had to go through when they came here? Like that, you know, it's always like that. Like, you know, first couple of generations in this way will go through some hardships and difficulties. And it is, you know, all because, you know, Prabhupada came here to establish something which is very, very unusual for this world. And why Prabhupada had to do that? Because Prabhupada was actually establishing something which is diametrically opposed to what this world is pursuing. Today's world is based on sense gratification. And Prabhupada came here to establish a culture which is based on spiritual foundation. In one hand is sense gratification, and on the other, like in one hand the total absorption in body consciousness, and Prabhupada came to establish something which is based on spiritual consciousness. So it's diametrically opposed. So their activities are also very opposed. And so, you know, there is a conflict. There is the conflict of, like, behavior, conflict of aspirations, conflict of culture. Like, they're dressing in a certain way. Why they're dressing in a certain way? In order to allure you to sense gratification. And Prabhupada established a dress code which is conducive to spiritual consciousness. Their culture is based on sense gratification. Prabhupada came to give a culture where you have to reject the sense gratification. So there is, you know, a natural conflict in that. And that is what is causing. And now we have kind of tried to bring them up with that spiritual consciousness, but at the same time we are not able to give them a platform which is properly established. Now, you know, they are indoctrinated with the spiritual culture. Now they have to now be in that world, in the material world. So what to do, you know? Like, we have to take it with a pinch of salt and with a you know, good amount of remorse that we are not able to give them what they actually deserved. Therefore, instead of forcing it down their throat, it's better to just let them go through their lives. And that's the way I feel myself. Like, I had gone through my life and then I made the decision to take to Krishna consciousness. So give them that liberty also. Let them also go through their life and then let them make their decision. And they are in a fortunate position because from in the childhood they got a very good dose of Krishna consciousness, which we didn't have. So in that way they are more fortunate. Now let them decide. They have seen spiritual culture. Now let them go and see the material culture and then let them make the choice. You're thinking, yeah, right. Yeah, I think we should be liberal with them, you know, not get upset that they are behaving in this way. You know, like, I mean, let us be honest with ourselves. How did we behave? How did our parents see us when we are young? I mean, time changed, like probably the world was not as degraded as that time. Like those days, we've been naughty. Like, we bunked school. And that was a big thing, to bunk school. And now, probably bunking class is not a big deal, but taking dopes is a big deal as a student. But you know, they're trying it out, let them. As long as they don't become addicted to it. Yes?
So saying let them live their lives, indirectly saying let them live their lives.
Well,
for their marriage life later on, which could leave some scars.
That's what you are thinking. When they are into it, they are not thinking it that way. Like when it is a norm, like, what can be done? Like, I mean, that's why I'm saying that they're fortunate that they got a good dose of Krishna consciousness and they know what to do and what not to do. But let them, give them the choice to decide for themselves what they want to do. Because how can you control them? You may think that, well, I will control every single move of my child, but will you be able to do that? Therefore, at some point, you know, you have to just give them the freedom, give them the liberty, and hope for the best. And in the meantime, give them the clear understanding. Look, this is right and this is wrong. If you don't do the wrong thing, don't deviate from the right path. Give them that understanding and let them. And have that, like, I can tell you one thing, that in my life I was very fortunate that my father gave me that understanding, that he had full confidence in me that I would never do anything wrong. And I knew that is the expectation of my father. And because if I loved my father, I should not. So this is how we have to bring them up. Don't do it because of my love for you and your love for me. So that is why, you know, like, what is important that we bring them up with our love and care and affection. By being strict, it's not going to serve the purpose. But with love, we may be able to.
In that light, I wanted to share something that my father actually taught me since I was young. He was very emphatic throughout my life. He used to say that he would give me a as much maturely and affectionately as he could. But the decisions that I make in my life were going to affect my life. And he was trying to show me what was best. But ultimately, I'll be responsible for whatever
comes. Right.
Does that apply exactly equally to both boys and girls? Knowing well that, because according to the scriptures, the psychology of a woman and a man are very different. One can be very easily misled, etc. That sort of bringing the freedom and independence seems to be more relevant to men, to young boys, than to girls.
I don't know. Because I am not very experienced in that world. But I know one thing, that how degraded the world is. I had the good fortune or misfortune of seeing the Western world before I became a devotee. I'll give you an example how promiscuous this society is, and how can we expect that, you know, anyone who goes there will remain pure the way we are expecting. Like, when I was in Germany, I'm telling you, that's an early 70s, right? Good 40 few years back. At that time, you see, the students, you see, there are things called student and home, you know, so hostels, university hostels. And the students in the third year of university hostels, they have the option to move into a room where two persons can stay. And these rooms were meant for a boy and girl. So the university system is actually leading you to that a boy and a girl will live together. Like yesterday, I was actually about to address that. Like the general feeling is that American society is degraded. I'll say European society is much worse. I mean, and I used to hang out with those with the American exchange students, exchange program students, and you know, I mean, what the local students were, I mean, compared to them, they were like saints. Because they had such a high standard of, you know, morality and things. So, now, you see, like when we are sending our children to the university, we have to understand that we are exposing them to that kind of a culture. Premam Pallavi, how are you? We all are missing you. And Vidura?
At a young age, keep the whole situation as black and white, good or bad. How can we train our kids that they are not judgmental to those who are not favorable to Krishna consciousness?
Well, make them, let them associate with people, those who are also, those who are outside of Krishna consciousness, so that they can have a clear understanding that those people, how they are, and we should not kind of paint things in black and white. That those who are not in ISKCON, they are, you know, or that kind of concept. Rather, we have to make them understand that nice people are there also. And although they are indulging in some activities which may not be right according to our standards, but that is the culture, so they are, that's why they are indulging in those activities. But you for yourself don't do that. That's what when you go to their house, you are going to school, you'll have your friends and you'll go to their houses and you will see that they are eating meat and doing different things, and but you don't do that because that's not right. Although they are doing it, you should understand that that's not the right thing to do.
In America, everybody respect each other's culture, you know. You go somewhere and people are different and accept your very different. But
yeah, that is nice. That is, but then again, that is a product of democracy. Like, we have to understand that everything is not right. That's Mayavad. There is a consideration of right and wrong. If that is the thing, like culture, everybody, respect everybody's culture, then why don't you respect a dacoit's culture or a thief's culture? If every culture is acceptable, then why aren't you accepting the terrorists? That is their culture. So there is a consideration of right and wrong. And ultimately there is a consideration of absolute right. So that is what Krishna consciousness is giving us. There, this kind of tolerance and things are a product of weakness and impersonalism. Because they're weak to deal with that, that's why they're just accepting everything. But if a person is strong, and in democracy you can't expect them to be strong. The strength actually comes from right leadership. And when there is leadership, then it's, Prabhupada said, like, what is democracy? If everyone is equal, everyone has equal rights, then why are you electing a president? Why are you electing a prime minister? Why are you electing the state premiers? That means you want a leader. Everybody wants a leader to look up to. Now find the right leader. Then only your life will become successful. But what you are doing in the name of democracy, you are electing wrong persons as your leaders. And the result is the world is becoming degraded. Yes, yes.
When you say that we should have remorse, personally, I can't live with it because it's easier for me to think that Krishna has put certain souls, these children have come, we thought they would all become pure devotees, but that's another illusion. These children have come because they had some baggage before. And they were given an opportunity, and they are still being given an opportunity. And by Krishna's perfect arrangement, everyone concerned is kind of forced to make some spiritual advancement. I mean, in my situation, I really felt it, that everyone in my family it was very difficult, but everyone made spiritual advancement. Even if the result doesn't look real good right now, it will. It's just a question of time. But when I think about remorse, I think that most parents, I've watched the parents, and most parents did the best they could with what they had at the time. We were struggling, you know.
Yeah, and rest assured, it will bear its fruit.
It will.
Right. Because, you see, with a devotee, we cannot really judge him according to what he is going through right now. The ultimate test will be at the time of death. That is the life of a devotee. Like in Krishna consciousness, we have seen just the other day, I was telling, like, so many devotees left the movement, fallen down, and, you know, gone through a very, very degraded situation. But before they were leaving the body, they came back to Krishna consciousness. And they left their body in such a way that we could see that they have gone back to Godhead. Right? So, similarly, maybe we have to also consider that our children, at least in their youth, in their early age, they've got a good base of Krishna consciousness. Like, that is the credit of their parents. The time when they were under their control, under their custody, they took care of them. They gave them Krishna consciousness. When they became independent, then they drifted away, some of them. But because they have got their Krishna consciousness at an age which is the most formative age of the life, at the final time moment, at the last moment, or at some point, they'll come back. Because you know what the material nature is like. It's full of suffering. So let them go through that. When they're young, probably they'll think that they're enjoying. But eventually they'll realize that they're suffering. When they realize that they're suffering, what they will do? They'll run back to Krishna consciousness. And we have to keep our doors open. Okay, anytime you want to come back, you can come back. We are not going to judge you for what you have done. We'll judge you from what you want to do right now. That's how we have to be. But unfortunately, sometimes it's not like that. We are judging people, judging devotees according to what they have done in the past. Oh, you have done this, you have done that to me. No forgiveness. Our door is closed to you forever. That should never be our attitude. Our door is always open to you. You can come back anytime you want to, and we will accept you with open arms.
Look at our movement, look, as you were saying, how the worst people were sent to be the children. And when you speak about the Lord, I never had any children of my own. I was always protected in Christian consciousness. And when I was the temple president, and I found out what he did to our kids, my heart broke. And when they first started investigating what went on at the school, the lady that first did child protection, he was living here. And anyone who has any softness of heart, these children came, and Prabhupada loved these children. You see the pictures of Prabhupada giving them, cookies. And I was here in L.A. When I first met Prabhupada and how he related with the children. And when I first heard the story of what these children went through, it broke my heart. And when I was the temple president, there was a number of years when they first had the legal cases and all the temples had to give funds. And I was willing at that time to do what I needed to do to try to raise the funds, and it was very difficult on me. And I never, I never was a part of any of that. I never knew any of what was going on. But at the same time, it very, very much affected me. And it even affected my Krishna consciousness for many years. For me, it was like a weight that I still carry, and an embarrassment when I meet people outside of our movement, intelligent people. And it's something that I've thought about a lot and I've discussed a lot, and that, yes, it's been so important to look at, so, that the mistakes aren't created again, that we don't perpetuate the same scenarios again. And so when I see certain young people acting in certain ways, I remember them as very young children. And I remember the things that happened to them. And I think, that the whole thing, like you said, the open door policy. And I know that when my in my own life, you know, I didn't come from a Vaishnava family. My family were eaters. They had so many problems. But my mother and my father, they never closed the door on me. And before I became a devotee, I was influenced by the whole generation. I wasn't exactly, you know, the best example. But my parents never closed the door. And what was the end result? You know, the end result was that in my own time, the values that were given to me, you know, by my family, you know, those were the values that became important. The values that became important to me. But I, as far as with the second generation, it's something that I feel is so, I personally feel so strong about. And although I never had anything to do with anything, I never had any children, I never worked for Gurukula, I was never even known. But when it was brought to my attention, it was, you know, how could I not feel remorse? How could I not feel the pain of others? You know?
And I'll say it's never too late. We can always offer our love to them. And that's what they need, that's what everybody needs. You know, just consider what does this movement stand for? This movement actually stands for love. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to give us the understanding and taste of what real love is. So that's what we have to understand, you know. But, you know, like, it hurts me, you know, and frustrates me, you know, when I see that in our institution there is such an acute shortage of love.
You're
still giving to the devotees, but everybody is feeling that,
I mean,
they
want
to hear.
I was just saying, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think that the best kids that came out are kids that had parents who were oriented properly with Krishna consciousness. They really loved Prabhupada. They really loved the holy name. Whereas many parents were maybe not quite fixed up right. They were fanatical and they probably had problems with their orientation to Krishna consciousness, and the kids inherited that. I mean, I mean, you look at some of the kids that have made it through, like Lord Vanya. Kiyonanda, and all of his kids are devotees, I think. He loved Prabhupada, and he just loved the holy name, and because he loved, and he was liberal, he let his kids watch television and stuff like that. But because he loved Prabhupada, and that was supermost in his life, the kids inherited that, and they still felt free to touch base with the material world and stuff, but they had that memory that my dad, he had the best thing, and he wasn't afraid of the television. He wasn't afraid of all these other influences. And so they actually passed into becoming devotees, too. So much depends on the orientation of the parents, I think. The kids will reflect that to a positive or negative degree.
Thank you, Lachan Prabhu. Yes, Lila Sukh.
The last couple of days, we've been discussing relationships, and today this topic has really been focused on children and the things that you've been saying about having love and open arms and not being fanatical. And I'm wondering if this same temperament would be appropriate to have, like, in other relationships, like if someone spouse deviates from Krishna consciousness and goes outside, would this be a good family policy in general?
It will depend upon the individuals, you know, like, it's because, you know, it's a very personal kind of a relationship, but our general attitude, you know, should be to give them the right understanding to both the parties. Right? Like if one party deviates or goes astray, then you know, just to make a blanket statement that the other party has to be kind and tolerant and, you know, and carry on with life with her, you know. Like, we can't make such a statement. We have to see the emotional, you know, effect of that person, how he is taking. I mean, it would be nice, like, sometimes. Another thing is that, you see, the way it is, I don't know why, but I will say at least, you know, the moral culture or social culture is that, that if a man becomes polygamous, it is not considered to be such a bad crime. But for a woman to become polygamous is not desirable. Right? So, I don't know why, but that is the thing, like, and of course, ideal would be when we are properly situated in Krishna consciousness, then we'll become, all become very moral in our behavior. Krishna consciousness brings the highest morality. But until one comes to that platform, at least he should honor the social norms. Even the cultured human, civilized human society doesn't accept certain kind of conduct. So we have to take that into consideration and stay within that. But, you know, the problem is that today's society, as I was saying, has become so promiscuous. Like, I mean, they don't feel even the need to get married. For a man and woman to develop relationship, what was the civilized civilized expectation? The expectation of a civilized society. When a grown-up man and a woman come together, they should become united through the social custom of marriage. But look what has happened. Even in barbaric society, this was an accepted conduct. That man and a woman must get together. And those society did not approve of polygamy. But today, you know, the polygamy has become the norm. And they are going beyond polygamy. You know, like you see, when you go into the material direction, you'll always want to get something new and adventurous. That's what they want, you know. Now, you know, so at some point, the society became polygamous. And now, polygamy also is not a big deal. So now, a new trend has come, homosexuality. Right? It's because, you know, they want something, they're always looking for something new. And they're inventing something new. And this is the natural consequence of a very, very gross materialistic culture. Yes? Is it?
Yeah.
Did he create? No. When somebody expressed that tendency, then he was punished in a certain way. The tendency may have been there. The tendency may have been there. But that tendency, just like stealing, is a tendency. Right? Murdering is a tendency. But that is not an accepted norm. Like they're rejected. They're disapproved by the society.
So are you saying that should not be accepted?
Homosexuality?
Oh, yeah.
No.
What I've seen as far as that goes is when it's not accepted, then there's a lot of family problems. Like, if a man is homosexual and he thinks that he needs to be heterosexual, and the actual tendency is there in the heart and desire.
You see, like, that's what I was saying, when the society becomes degraded, then there is no limit to what extent they will go. But the point is, that should not become the standard. Right? Look at it. I mean, what is our standard? What standard we are trying to implement? No illicit sex. Right? No illicit sex. We are not saying no sex. We are saying no illicit sex. Now, what is the purpose of sex? Procreation. Procreation. So, legitimate sex is for the sake of procreation. Now, you know, like, now tell me, in which category homosexuality fall?
Honestly, I think that there can be couples who are of the same sex that can be platonic and monogamous. And I think that sometimes they even follow more strictly than...
But is it going on for the sake of procreation?
There's no sex. It's a union where two people are committed to living.
That union is based on sex.
Okay.
Right. That union is based on that. Yeah. Right. I mean, then what's the point in, you know, social approval? Like, if you have some attraction, like, you know, I develop friendship with my friends, right? I mean, I didn't need any social approval for that. I didn't have to get married to develop my friendship with him. When the considerations like that come in, then we have to understand that we are talking about not only subtle sex, we are talking about gross sex. Yeah.
Mark, what about some of the studies made that when a child's growing up, sometimes like a boy, he'll start to manifest homosexual tendencies at 6 years old, like that?
That is okay. Like, even when you see the animals, like the calves, you know, like, they didn't develop the sex desire, and you feel that, you know, you see that they're displaying some kind of homosexual tendency. But that is an act, you know, like an appreciation for each other that kind of comes out in a certain way. But when one becomes a man, that those tendencies disappear. Like, you know, see, in an inherent way, in the subtle body, sex desire is there, right? And when one is young, though in the subtle body the sex desires are there without, you know, practically understanding or body being, you know, suitable for that act, there is a display of that kind of tendency. That is, you know, like the body is not really mature enough, the body is not really suitable enough for that. But when the body comes to that stage, then the sex desires take its matured shape, and it comes out in the form of attraction for the opposite sex. Prior to that, you know, the attraction is there for the other body, but not really knowing, you know, what it is actually. It's kind of that's what you're addressing.
I've talked to teachers who observe children, and there's like some boys who, they're so attracted to feminine sort of activities as they grow up, and it never seems to leave them. They're always attracted to being hairdressers, or, you know what I mean? And it just stays with them, almost like maybe in their previous life they wanted to be a woman so bad, and then you have to stuck with a man for 5 years.
Well, then again, I will just, you know, sum it up with that, with the understanding that, well, these are all the products of our material conditioning. But our business is to transcend the material condition and come to the spiritual platform. So, you know, but if we give vent to this conditioning and justify that, you know, this is, oh, he has a tendency, then let him do that. Then the question will come that everybody has a tendency for sex desire. Then why are we making devotees to lead a life of a brahmachari? Why we should justify only the attraction for the same sex? What's wrong with the attraction of the opposite sex? which is a natural thing. Now why are we telling our brahmacharin and brahmacharinis that that should be given up for our spiritual benefit? So that is where we should actually begin from. That, you know, and I tell you, like, even these people, those who are promoting that, they understand that. But they are just doing it because they want the society to become degraded. Because, you know, they are just handing, they are playing in the hands of Kali. Yes, Leela Sir.
So taking into consideration that humans are showing up with their desires and conditioning from previous lives, it seems to me that if there's a political policy on that, that there's going to be a lot of people who miss out on progressing spiritually.
Well, there are so many meat eaters. Their natural tendency is to eat meat. Why aren't we accepting them in our, within our fold? Why do we have the policy no meat eating? If we give out, accept your argument, then I have to say, well, then let allow the meat eaters also join ISKCON, because that is their natural tendency from their previous karma, from the previous conditioning. We are missing out on so many people. Prabhupada said that I have these four regulative principles. If I compromise with one, I would have got many more. But I am not going to do that. Because I don't want number. I don't want quantity, I want quality.
Two things come up to me in response to that, and one is that it's not, I'm not saying that there should be three principles. I mean, the reality is that whether people get married or not, the people are engaged in sex life.
But that's not.
That many times.
But at least, you know, like openly, or it cannot be our policy. What somebody is doing in a, doing quietly or like that is not the standard. You see, our standard is very clear. No illicit sex. But if somebody indulges in that, you know, behind closed door, then what can be done? At least, you know, we have our standard and we must stick to that standard.
So are you assuming that when heterosexual couples get married that they are only going to engage in sexual activity for procreation?
That's what Prabhupada wanted.
I don't know.
That is the standard.
I know that's the standard, but it's...
And why so many people are defecting from ISKCON today? Because the standard is not maintained. Like, I mean, my very clear understanding is we have to stick to the standard that Srila Prabhupada gave.
Yeah.
But there is no compromise on that. You know, like, I mean, anyway, my simple argument or my simple presentation in that respect will be that even animals don't indulge in sex life other than for the sake of procreation. Then what to speak of human beings? Shouldn't they at least have a standard which is little higher than a human, little higher than an animal standard? But we are actually degrading even below the animal standard.
What the assumptions that I hear are that when heterosexual people get married, that they're only going to engage in sexual activity for procreation, and when homosexual people partner, that they will in fact engage in sexual activity. And which obviously will not be for procreation. Like, I hear really different things for the genders that are involved.
You see, like, why do you have the social approval of living together and sleeping together? Let's come to that point. If it's just friendship, why do you have to live together and sleep together? I mean, I had many friends, like, as a young boy, our relationship was very deep, so deep that, you know, if I didn't meet him one day, I felt my whole day has been spoiled, right? I mean, that kind of deep friendship I had with him. But not only him, I mean, there are others. But it never occurred that we have to sleep together, right? Or we have to have a social approval that will justify our relationship. There was no such consideration in it. Took it for granted, it was a natural thing. But that didn't go beyond our emotional platform. There was no physical need for that to justify that relationship or fulfill that relationship. Never occurred. To tell you frank, anyway, let's not get into that. What I was about to say is that, I find it extremely disgusting how a man can become attracted to a man. A man becoming attracted to a woman is understandable. A man becoming attracted to a man, in a physical sense,
He's preaching with me about distributing books. One point I was talking with him, I just put my hand on his shoulder and he just shot. He said, "Don't do it." So I said, "What?" So it's totally wrong in our country. He said, "What? Our friend we always do here. Never mind."
Yes, Lilashik, it seems that quite a lot of things are going in at the back of your mind. Tell me, we are having a frank and open discussion. Do you think that something is that I'm saying is shocking or?
Well, I was thinking.
Are there? I need to understand something.
I was thinking, you were saying that it's the natural tendency of the jiva to be in relationship and to have this love, which is ultimately for joy, and to think that the individuals who are born into a situation where they are in fact homosexual, that they will live their life alone, not having a home with someone else.
They can join a brahmachari ashram. Bad luck. That reminds me. A few years back, I think 3 or 4 years back, I was in Spain in a interfaith conference. Generally, I don't attend interfaith conferences, but they assured me that this will be different. They'll be open, and we can have a topic. And anyway, so after 10 years, I actually attended that interfaith conference. And then at one point, one evening, we all were sitting together. There was a Christian person, two Jewish persons, one Muslim, and myself. They were having dinner. I was just sitting there, drinking fruit juice. and we are discussing, and the discussion veered onto homosexuality. And they asked me what was my opinion on that. And I said, it is demoniac. And it shocked them. And I was surprised. These are religious people, religious leaders. And even they are thinking that homosexuality is all right. So if I knew, then probably I would have been a little diplomatic in my presentation. But I just, when they asked me, I was very, straightforward on that. I said, it's demoniac. And it was so shocking. For some time, they all were quiet. And I started to feel kind of embarrassed, for shocking them like that. And then, one thing just came to my mind, and I just spelled it out. I said, why did God want to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? Do you know that? And it just made, you know, some, you know, sense to them, you know. And one of the Jewish person, you know, he said, yes, it was immoral. It was sinful. This act. Because the creation, you see, if we accept that Krishna created everything with a purpose, Krishna created man and women with a purpose, and that to function on that purpose is dharma, and to act on contradiction to that purpose is adharma. Men have been created with a purpose. Similarly, women have been created with a purpose. So that's what Krishna is saying, that kamoshmi bharatarshava, dharma aviruddha kamoshmi bharatarshava, that lust or sex life that is not contradictory to dharma, that is me. I am that. And that is, what is the sex life on the platform of dharma? Procreation. And sex life for procreation is Krishna himself. So that we have to understand, and that we have to accept. You know, like we tend to get carried away by, you know, the trend that prevails. But at least our devotees should not be. You know, devotees should stick to, you know, the principles of dharma. You know, somebody cannot control himself, that's why be liberal to him. That is not our policy. Then tell me, which brahmachari can control his sex desire? But still, why he is doing it? Because it is beneficial for his spiritual advancement. Especially in this world, you know, when you go out and where there is always, you know, sexual agitation, all kinds of allurement for provoking to sex life. I mean, do you think it's easy to control your sex life? No. But for the sake of our spiritual advancement, we have to do it. Anyway. No, I'll say devotee. No, I'm not saying homosexuals cannot be a devotee. I say a devotee shouldn't be a homosexual. Try to curb his propensity. Just as a brahmachari has to control his sex desire.
The propensity can be curbed, but the tendency is still there. And sort of once someone
try one life, try it for one life. At the end, you'll get an appropriate body. And practice makes the man perfect. Like, do you think it was easy to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning when you joined the movement? That was, for me, that was the most difficult thing. For me, that was the most difficult thing. To get up in the morning at 6, up at 4 o'clock, I never ever dreamt of doing that in my whole life. And so I began with that. I mean, sort of, you know, it was difficult to get up at 4 o'clock. And now what to speak of 4 o'clock? I get up at 2 o'clock on my own. Nobody had, I didn't use an alarm clock for last more than 25 years. So practice makes a man perfect. So the propensities may be there, tendencies may be there. But practice in the right association, you will be able to overcome those propensities. After all, the body is a matter, you know, body is subject to conditioning. But we have to uncondition those bodies with our Krishna consciousness. If you take that argument, or if you take that point, I mean, if you take that logic and argument, then I'll honestly say, you won't get any Krishna consciousness. There won't be any Krishna consciousness. Everybody will do his own thing. Krishna consciousness means restrictions. Material life means a criminal life. A criminals have to be punished. criminals have to be taught to give up their criminal propensities. If you say allow the criminals to act in a criminal way, then there won't be any possibility of finding a society that is just and fair. Go ahead.
Multiple things have come to mind. You said that it is demoniac, homosexuality is demoniac, and that heterosexuality is dharma.
Not only heterosexuality, sex life or procreation.
Right. Yes. So would that, to me that applies to both, whether somebody's heterosexual or homosexual, sex life is for procreation, and that's the only way that it's dharma. And people marry for different reasons. Like, not everyone is going to have children if they're before they marry, because there's a need.
Maybe in a degraded society, but in a civilized human society, the purpose of marriage is procreation.
And are we working in a...
Putrarthe kriyate bharja. One accepts, gets married to a wife for the sake of procreation. And I'll also add one point here. That not only, you know, appropriate sex life, but actually spiritual life means total abstinence from sex life. Sex life means material attachment. Sex life means bondage. This material, come to think of it, this material nature is a prison house of sex desire. Everyone is tied down to this material nature with sex desire. Therefore, if we want to get out of this material nature, we have to get rid of sex desire.
Then we should all be sannyasis?
Huh?
Then we should all be sannyasis?
Not that, but abstain from sex life. At some point. You have the choice, like, yeah, the thing is that not that everybody has to become a sannyasi. Rather, Prabhupada is saying every woman should get married. Because the motherhood is the purpose of a woman's existence. Woman's fulfillment of a woman's existence is in her motherhood. Therefore, Prabhupada is saying every woman should get married. Women don't have to be brahmacharinis, and in Vedic culture, there is no consideration of a woman becoming a sannyasi. Well, fine. The thing is that Krishna consciousness is a platform which is perfect in all respects. Irrespective of one's ashram and varna, everybody can be situated in Krishna consciousness and achieve the ultimate perfection of his existence. We don't have to be sannyasis or brahmacharis or householders. As Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, we don't have to become brahmanas, kshatriyas, shudras. Our ultimate goal is to become a servant of the servant of Krishna. So by becoming that, we'll be able to transcend all these bodily designations and all these bodily propensities and conditionings. And that's why my point is, if we give in to, you know, these undesirable activities, then it will very badly hurt our movement.
Do you think it'll be worse than Vaishnavis killing themselves because they're homosexual and this has been such a hard line for them? Or do you think it'll be worse if we give in that there are...
No, I'm not saying... No, obviously I will not approve of it. No, I will not say that because you can't control your tendency or propensity, you go and kill yourself. I would rather say, practice the process properly. Be in the right association and practice Krishna consciousness, and you'll be able to overcome that. As I said, I couldn't get up at 4 o'clock before, but now I get up at 2 o'clock. Because of proper practice in the right association.
What's happened is that because of this hard line with homosexuality,
okay, then my point will be, because somebody has committed suicide because he is a homosexual, in ISKCON we have to accept homosexuality? Because somebody committed a suicide?
No,
I'm saying being accepting about some where people are at, not that they should feel excluded. Not that they should feel like they're so demoniac that they can't.
Then if they cannot help it, then let them do it outside of ISKCON. Just as, you know, people are eating meat. We are not saying that if you can't become a vegetarian, then go and kill yourself. Okay, if you can't become a vegetarian, stay out of ISKCON and come and practice the practices. And when you are qualified, when you are able to give up, then you can come. Yes, Guru Varun?
You know, the struggles that homosexuals or heterosexuals have are the same to give up sex life. And, you know, in grihastha ashram or whatever, that has to be given up, even if one's living with his wife.
Lila Shukra, come. Don't. I didn't want to hurt you. It's all right.
I joined this movement thinking everyone was accepted. I've seen so many people in pain around this topic. Oh, but Prabhupada disciples have come to me and talked to me about how much they've suffered over the years. Feeling like they can't be themselves and they can't fully give their heart to this movement because they're not accepted.
Yeah.
I've seen my stomach.
But
no,
come on,
so
Lila Shuk, that try to understand one thing, that there is a condition to join this movement. And the condition of joining this movement is that there is no illicit sex.
And what if people can live without having sex and be either heterosexual or homosexual? Can't that be...
No, that's the same point I'm making right now, I mean, as I did earlier. That because somebody cannot do that, do we have to give up our standard that Srila Prabhupada established?
Will you? Actually,
no, no, that's not true. That's not true. That's a misrepresentation.
Well,
Prabhupada would never say that, okay, continue with your homosexual activities within ISKCON because you can't stay without it.
I grew up in New Orleans, and there were so many people who came to the temple, not because of an inclusive spirit. They were able to take up the process and feel welcome there. And then a temple president came who was really, like, hardcore about everybody needs to get married and everybody needs to be heterosexual. And it cleared. I mean, it was just like that kind of spirit. It excludes so many people, and we're not working in an ideal civilization. We are in a degraded civilization.
I tell you, Lila Sukh, I mean, I again repeat that. Prabhupada said that if we could, instead of four, if we had three regulative principles, I could have got many more people join this movement. But I cannot compromise on that. The standard that has been established by our previous acharyas, the standard that has been established by Krishna himself. Dharma stands on four legs. Right? And those four legs we cannot compromise. If we are trying to pursue the path of Dharma, then those four pillars of Dharma must be intact. And the point is the sex life has to be given. Sex, as I said, like what we are aspiring for. We are aspiring for elevation to the spiritual sky. Getting out of the material bondage. Getting out of the material nature. And go back to the spiritual sky. And now tell me, in that, what is the most difficult bondage in this material nature?
Right.
So we have to give it up. But there is, you know, certain way that sexual propensities can be utilized. And that is for procreation. And also try to remember that, you know, why people indulge in sex life? Because of pleasure that goes along with that. Now, why that pleasure is there in sex life? Because the process of procreation is very painful. If that initial pleasure was not there, no one would indulge in sexual acts. and there wouldn't have been any progeny. That's why, you know, Brahma added a little bit of, you know, sense pleasure in that process. But if we forget the actual purpose of it and then get caught up with just the sense pleasure aspect of it, then tell me, is this the ultimate purpose of our existence? Can that ever be the ultimate purpose of our existence? Especially when we are trying to perfect our lives. Thank you, Lila Shukran. I'm sorry if I hurt you. Don't worry.
I just don't know what I'm going to say to people. Like, I understand that we're supposed to be giving up sex life. I got that. Like,
don't discuss about this. Well, you don't have to say anything to people. Just stay quiet.
I do, because people come and talk to me about this very topic, and I see suffering, like, in old devotees who have been repressing, like, their hearts are so shut down because they feel so not accepted.
Yeah.
And I just...
Okay, I mean, the thing is, you know, the acceptance comes with a purpose. If somebody comes and tells, I hate Krishna, will you accept him? Will you accept him? If somebody says that I don't believe in Krishna, you all are just idol worshippers, will you accept him? Come to think of it, to begin with, to join ISKCON, we have rejected everybody. Didn't we? At least I had to do that. I had to reject my family, I had to reject my friends, and my choice was, this is the path I'm taking. If you can't understand and accept it, I have nothing to do with you. And that's how I stepped into ISKCON. Right? That is our very primeval consideration. Like, we stand on a principle, we stand on an ideology, we stand on an objective. Right? It's not a, you know, a sentimental thing that, oh, I love you, therefore, in order to accept you, I have to adjust my belief, my faith, my practice. Rather, when you go out and preach, what do we say? What do we do? We stay firm on our thing, right? And you are making a statement by wearing a sari. You are making a statement. It's not accepted in this world, but you are wearing it. Why? Because you are making a statement that you have accepted a certain lifestyle, you have accepted certain ideology, you have accepted certain way of committing yourself. So it is not a matter of how they will think. Like, you know, 100 billion people in this world don't accept what we are doing. But does it deviate us from our objective? No. Rather, we stay firm on that.
I'm talking about Vaishnavas. I'm talking about devotees who are born into this movement as homosexuals, or devotees who have given decades of their life to serve Srila Prabhupada's movement that haven't fully been able to give.
Come to think of it, you know, we all are born with a propensity for sexual attraction. Right. Then what am I doing here? Why did you take sannyas? I had to make a choice. That no to sex life. I had to make a choice.
And that's what it sounds like you're recommending, that we all be like sannyas.
I'm not recommending that everybody should become a sannyas. I'm simply recommending that the standard that Srila Prabhupada gave, we must stick to that. And that is no illicit sex. So think about it, don't become emotional, don't get upset, and we love you. And when I see that you are shedding tears, I feel sad. It makes me feel very, very heartbroken. Please don't feel bad. Rather, try to understand why I am saying what I am saying. Hare Krishna. What is?
What is liberating about having babies who are 6 weeks of age can be deposited in childcare centers to learn their behavior and morality from strangers?
I couldn't get.
Can you read it slowly? What is liberating about having babies?
What is liberating?
What's liberating about having babies? Who at 6 weeks of age
what?
6 weeks of age can be deposited in a childcare center and learn morality from someone else rather than the mother. So what's the big deal about being a mother? What's so liberating about it?
Well, I mean, we are not dealing with the abnormal cases. We are talking about the, when we make a point, when we stand for a certain principle, we are talking about the normal situation. A mother gives birth to a baby and she should take care of the baby, feed the baby, and clean the baby and take care of the baby. And let the baby grow up. Not that just give birth and then dump the baby or abort the baby. That's not motherhood. Then?
Another question from Ravanan.
Sharanagati, there was another part of that thing later.
That's
part.
It.
That's it. Sharanagati, did it answer your question? I mean, if you're still there, you can say whether. My point is that just being a mother, motherhood doesn't mean just to give birth to the child. Motherhood also includes bringing up the child in a proper way. And ultimate culmination of the motherhood is to make the child Krishna conscious. That is the purpose of motherhood. Yes, and Daipan's question is?
What does stay out of ISKCON mean?
What does stay out of ISKCON mean? To stay away from the association of devotees, stay away from the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, stay away from the shelter of the lotus feet of Srila Prabhupada. Any other questions? That's all. Okay. Thank you very much. Had a long class today. Exactly 2 hours. Anyway, today is Ekadasi, a day meant for Krishna Katha.